We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last month, Rolling Stone magazine published a story by a reporter named Sabrina Rubin Erdley. The story alleged the gang rape of a first-year student identified by the pseudonym Jackie. It was at a fraternity house, the story said, at the University of Virginia back in 2012. The story was meant to highlight the prevalence of sexual assault on college campuses, and the Rolling Stone reporter built the story around this unnamed student, Jackie, who claimed she had been raped by seven fraternity brothers. And according to the story, because the young men's privilege and the university's indifference to this story, they escaped justice. Now, one problem with the story I have to mention is a compelling narrative, but it doesn't seem to be true. We don't know what part of it is true at this point. After Rolling Stone published the story, the Washington Post did its own investigating, found that huge elements didn't hold up. And Rolling Stone editors have since retracted this story. Joining me now to discuss the article, the fallout, and the lessons learned from two very interesting perspectives, Gigi Durham is with us. She's a professor with a joint appointment in two departments at the University of Iowa, the School of Journalism and Mass Communication, and also in the Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies Department at the UI. Gigi Durham, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben.
Also with us, Susan Junis, a University Prevention Education Coordinator at the Rape Victims Advocacy Program in Iowa City. Susan Junis, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
In this half hour, I want to reach out to our listeners as well. What can we learn, in your view, about journalism, the coverage of campus assault, by looking at what's happened with this Rolling Stone University of Virginia article? 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Gigi Durham, tell us, let's start with the journalism end of things. What went wrong here in terms of journalism that you can see?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story, and its aftermath is also interesting in terms of journalistic practice. And, you know, I want to say up front that I wish we could disentangle the journalism from the issue of rape, but we can't in this particular story. They're so deeply sort of intertwined. When I first read the story, and it ran, I think it broke on November 19th, I looked and I thought, well, of course, Rolling Stone must have, the editors must have checked it. The, you know, legal counsel must have looked at it, because in every, I mean, I have a background in journalism myself, and every newspaper I've worked on, every magazine I've worked on, if it was a story like this with, you know, huge implications in terms of potential defamatory content and, just controversial and, you know, a story that would garner this much attention, my editors would have gone over it with a fine-tooth comb. You know, probably the legal staff would have looked at it. So I assumed that all that had happened at Rolling Stone. And then, as it turns out, it looks like it really didn't, because so many of the facts in the story didn't seem to be supported, as you say, on further investigation. You know, for example, the victim apparently said, you know, the rape survivor, Jackie, apparently said that the rape took place on a particular date. When they went to the fraternity house records, no event had happened at the house on that particular date. She apparently said it was part of a fall rush situation. They don't rush in the fall. She said she had met the alleged perpetrator when she was a lifeguard at the University of Virginia pool. Apparently, no member of that fraternity had ever worked there as a lifeguard. And so there were certain factual aspects of the story that indicate that Rolling Stone didn't exercise due diligence in terms of fact-checking. Now, I do want to say here, too, that because of this, unfortunately, it's thrown a great deal of doubt on the story and on Jackie's story. And, you know, with sort of typical overgeneralization, people now are sort of casting doubt on every aspect of it. And I just want to make it clear that just because Rolling Stone didn't check the facts, it doesn't mean that something didn't happen. It just makes it less clear.
There are several points at which we doubt the way it was narrated, told in Rolling Stone. It doesn't mean that some sort of sexual assault did not happen in this case to a person using the pseudonym Jackie.
Yeah.
What about this journalistic practice that the Rolling Stone reporter here evidently agreed with Jackie not to interview the alleged rapists?
Right.
This
is really problematic to me. I mean, because a one-source story, you know, I mean, every good journalist knows that a one-source story is probably not, you know, the most grounded or accurate account that you could have, just because any source, I mean, a victim of rape trauma, you know, of course, may have sort of particular problems in terms of being able to accurately recount what happened. I mean, when you're that traumatized, you may not have a clear memory of, you know, what date it was on or exactly what the facts are. But as we all know, as journalists, any source, you know, can be mistaken about what happened. You know, people might say that a particular lecture was on a Monday night when in fact it was on a Tuesday night, or they may, you know, cops know this too, that, witnesses in an accident could say it was a blue car when in fact it was a green car. Yeah. So, I mean, facts are always, you know, in a certain amount of doubt if you're relying on a single source, which is why journalists necessarily need to go to multiple sources, need to fact check, need to triangulate the evidence. And especially when there's, you know, there's going to be controversy around the story, or, you know, when a story like this really needs to be accurate in every respect before it's published. And it wasn't.
Mm-hmm. One final on a journalistic thing to talk with you about, the pseudonym. Jackie is used as a pseudonym now. When I look at the Associated Press's, for instance, guidelines on this, nothing in our news report, words, photos, graphics, sound, or video may be fabricated. We don't use pseudonyms, composite characters, or fictional names, ages, places, or dates. Is that generally practiced through all media news organizations? No pseudonyms used? Obviously not at the at the Rolling Stone magazine.
No, I mean, it's not a common sort of standard for in terms of the use of pseudonyms. And from what I understand, actually, I'm not sure about this. I would have to check it. But I think Jackie was actually her nickname. I mean, it wasn't a complete pseudonym. But in general, you don't use anonymous sources unless there's a compelling reason to mask the source. That is, there could be some danger to the source himself or herself. You know, that's a reason to use an anonymous source or a pseudonym. So the different publications have different standards in terms of when they use pseudonyms or mask identities. But usually it's because there's some real compelling reason why they need to hide the name of the source. I think in this case, actually, that compelling reason was there. You know, a lot of media have agreed, you know, sort of it's not a law, but there's a common practice of not revealing rape victims' names. And I think that is a good one, because there's often so much fallout for the survivor of the rape that it's probably better to protect her identity. The other thing I just wanted to say about this, Ben, as I've been thinking about this whole fact-checking business, you know, one thing we emphasize here at the University of Iowa and at every school of journalism I've ever been at, all of my degrees are in journalism and they're all from schools of journalism. The curriculum is designed to emphasize accuracy, fact-checking, you know, absolute sort of diligence in terms of making sure that your story is credible and correct. And obviously that didn't happen at Rolling Stone. And I'm thinking that, you know, part of me is thinking that it's because a lot of major national publications make a practice of hiring people from elite schools that don't have schools of journalism. And so, in fact, the writer of this story, Sabrina Erdely, got her degree at Penn, at the University of Pennsylvania. She says she was a journalism major, but they don't actually have a school of journalism. They have journalistic writing classes that are more like creative nonfiction writing classes. Mm. They have a school of communication, but not a school of journalism that has the type of editing, fact-checking. You know, all of our students are required to take media law. They don't have that sort of curriculum there. And her editor, Will Dana, came from Middlebury College. He got his degree there, and they don't have a school of journalism either.
Could it also be the fact that print journalism especially has been hit hard by the digital media, and that they're dwindling newsroom resources in terms of editorial resources to do the fact-checking? Could that be a factor?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Gannett, for example, a major media company, is actually starting to eliminate its editor positions. And I'm not sure what Rolling Stone's situation is in terms of having legal counsel or legal staff right there to check for potentially defamatory content. Now, in our School of Journalism, all the students have to take media law, and so they would be very sensitized to these issues. But you're absolutely right that the contemporary media environment, where they're eliminating the sort of layers of fact-checking that would, you know, click into place before a story like that is normally practiced, are dwindling.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about the controversy over the retracted Rolling Stone story about an alleged gang rape at a fraternity house at the University of Virginia. We're talking about what went wrong with the journalism. Now we want to talk about Susan Junis is with us, University Prevention Education Coordinator at the Rape Victims Advocacy Program in Iowa City. Your reaction to the story, given your perspective as a person who helps prevent sexual assault on campus and also deals with those who have been traumatized by sexual assault.
Right. I think in terms of this specific story, one thing that is very striking that has come out in the recent weeks since Rolling Stone issued their retraction is that Jackie actually asked to be taken off the story. She asked the author of the piece to not be included anymore.
At what point? Before the first publication?
Before publication, mm-hmm. and was denied. And I think that is a huge red flag. I'm not a journalist, and I am not familiar with journalistic ethics, but that seems like a pretty big red flag in that case. Another thing that we talk about when we talk about sexual assault and reporting about it is, you know, we don't want this situation to scare journalists away from reporting about sexual assault, because a lot of journalists feel, you know, that's difficult, it's too hard to verify, to validate that story. But I think if a journalist understands trauma and how trauma impacts the brain, that makes reporting about sexual assault a lot easier, or at least a lot more manageable. We know that most survivors of sexual assault do meet the criteria for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And we know that PTSD, one of the symptoms is memory loss, and that the way that trauma operates in the brain is that the brain builds walls around those memories, right? So that it keeps that survivor safe, right? Those memories are too intense for them to remember or even think about on a daily basis. So those walls are built, and so they're not able, as Gigi mentioned, not able to recall facts. And in fact, it makes a linear narrative impossible to recreate. And that's something that, you know, a lot of journalists, I think, have a hard time with. We want a linear narrative, right? A coherent narrative. But that's something that rape survivors are literally unable to produce.
Mm-hmm. In some cases. Gigi, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I think Susan's making an incredibly important point there. And actually, at some schools of journalism, like the University of Missouri, they actually have a class on reporting on victims of trauma. Because you know, a lot of victims of trauma in various circumstances, you know, have those sorts of emotional and cognitive and psychological reactions to the trauma. And so interviewing and reporting on those sorts of circumstances require specialized skills and knowledge. So I think that's very, very important. And I also want to reiterate that Jackie's story is not necessarily untrue. You know, it's, I feel, I mean, just reading about her, some of the reports from her roommates, for example, indicate that she, when she entered school, she was a very bright, happy, outgoing young woman, and that she, at some point around November, that she sort of underwent a personality change. She became very depressed. She became withdrawn, and she eventually withdrew from school before exams, from what I understand. And that's a very sort of typical arc for a rape survivor. I think Susan can probably attest to that. So something happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the crime of sexual assault compared to other crimes in terms of false reporting? Do they match up, or are they some cases of whatever crime we talk about are false reports? How does sexual assault match up?
Right. I think that the issue of false reporting is kind of underlying this entire story, or the way that we're talking about this story in our culture and our society. And when I do presentations with university students, this is something that comes up really frequently, where we have students, you know, I'll ask them what's a percentage of reports that are false reports? And routinely students will say, well, at least 50%, you know, maybe even 90%. You know, the reality is that false reporting of sexual assault is lower than any other crime. And it runs at about 2% are false reports. What we also know about false reporting is that, or about reporting in general, is that most sexual assaults are not reported at all. So we see statistics run about 40% of sexual assaults are actually reported to the police or other authorities. So we see that most aren't reported. And we know that while there are some people who lie about being sexually assaulted, the contextual piece that we often ignore is that almost all rapists lie about raping, but we don't see the same kind of interrogation about perpetrators that we do. We have this vested interest in our society about interrogating victims' experiences that we don't have about perpetrators.
You mentioned something earlier on I wanted to ask about again. You're afraid, you seem to be afraid, that this story, this nationwide story, would cut down on the number of people, reporters, willing to take on these cases. The fear there is that then it would be underreported in the media. So what words of encouragement can you offer so that a reporter is not less likely to take on a reporting on sexual assault?
The National Resource NSVRC, National Sexual Assault Resource Center, has a really great resource that it offers to journalists. They offer a course, an online course, and also an information packet to talk to journalists about how to report about this. You know, I'm concerned about journalists being willing to report about it, but I'm also concerned about the impact that's going to have on survivors yes. coming forward. Jackie's personal information has now been released mm-hmm. to the public by a blogger. Her address and full name has been published on the internet. That has a chilling effect on people being willing to come forward.
So even if you would be willing to come forward under certain conditions to a reporter somewhere, you might look at this story and say, well, nobody can really promise me rock solid anything, right, Gigi?
Yeah, that's part of my concern as well over this whole episode. You know, a Department of Justice study that was just released a few days ago says that college students are less likely to report rape than non-students. And so I feel as though this story may actually discourage, you know, rape survivors from reporting even more because of all the negative repercussions of this story. You know, the discrediting of the woman Jackie, and now that her identity has been released, I mean, she's probably going to be the victim of all sorts of calumny and attacks, and you know, just the ways in which people. You know, retaliate against or go after rape survivors is just astonishing and scary.
Mm-hmm. Remind us, Susan, about the prevalency of rape, sexual assault on campus. And we do know this doesn't only happen to women, right? Men can be the victims here as well. It's primarily women, though.
Absolutely. So we know lifetime prevalence is about 1 in 4 women, 1 in 6 men, and 1 out of every 2 transgender identified people will experience some form of sexual assault during their lifetime. When we look at the college years, during someone's time on college, we don't have good statistics for transgender identified people, but we know that 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men will experience some sort of sexual assault during their time on campus alone. One statistic I like to use is from the National Institute of Justice that says that for every 1,000 women who attend a college campus, there will be about 35 incidents of rape per academic year. If we were to use the University of Iowa as an example, there are 16,000 women who are enrolled at the University of Iowa. That would be about 457 rapes that are occurring per year just on our campus. So this
and,
is
how many are being reported?
Right. Very few. You know,
very few, a handful, a dozen.
Well, we've so far at the University of Iowa heard timely warnings that have been released. There have been 9, I believe, so far this academic year. There were 12 last year. So we know that what we're hearing is the tip of the iceberg, and that actually it's a little counterintuitive, but we actually want to hear more of those timely reports. We want to hear more because it means that more people feel safe enough to come forward.
So
and
when
report.
We hear about a rise in reports, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
Even though when we see it on a newspaper, it's distressing.
It is.
Uh-huh. Are we doing better? Can you see that we are doing better in the years when really some resources have been put towards this? You are one of these resources.
Absolutely. I think the university has really worked hard in the past few years to put resources toward sexual violence, both response and prevention. Recently, university administration announced that they would fund 3 full-time prevention educators for the University of Iowa campus, which is really great news.
Mm-hmm. Gigi Durham, we have about a minute left. Can you wrap this up and give us a takeaway, lessons learned from this Rolling Stone incident?
Right. I mean, I think there are sort of 2 big lessons that we can take from it. You know, one is that it is still absolutely imperative for journalists to check their facts. You know, that getting the story right, making sure that it's accurately reported is incredibly important. And to rely on a single source for any story is just not good journalistic practice. And especially when it's a victim of trauma, you know, you have to be very, very careful about how you report the story before you just run with it because it's going to, you know, get eyeballs or readers or whatever. But the other piece of that is that just because certain elements of that story didn't hold up under fact-checking doesn't mean that Jackie's story should be discredited. And it doesn't mean that sexual assault is not highly prevalent on college campuses and across our country. You know, it's still something that we need to be really, really concerned about. And I think maybe the big lesson to take away from all this is that reporters need to learn how to report on this crime. Mm-hmm.
Are you using this as an example, talking about this in your classrooms?
Actually, I was teaching a class called Writing Across Cultures this semester. It didn't specifically focus on gender issues, but certainly we talked about it in class. We absolutely did. And I'm really interested in maybe developing a course like the one that's taught at the University of Missouri on covering rape victims of trauma.
So. Okay. Well, perhaps you can remind us, Susan Junis, about how people can get in touch with the Rape Victim Advocacy Program in Iowa City. And there are other programs across the state, but I imagine we can use yours as a connector for all of them.
Absolutely. So RVAP has a 24-hour crisis line that is 319-335-6000, and that is available 24 hours a day, answered by trained advocates. And we're here to believe you if you are ready to talk about it.
Okay. Susan Junis is the University Prevention Education Coordinator at the Rape Victim Advocacy Program in Iowa City. Susan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Gigi Durham is in the departments of School of Journalism and Mass Communication, professor, also an appointment in the Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies Department at the University of Iowa. Professor Durham, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Garrett Van Leeuwen helped us out in Ames. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.